I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Ben Eshmade, and this week we're visiting our archive, looking back to March 2016, when we spoke to composer George Benjamin and countertenor Yeston Davies, just before the premiere of the then new work Dream of the Song. Performed as part of a 3-concert series entitled Benjamin at the Barbican, this podcast has turned out to be a document of the composer and the composition process just before the premiere of this piece.
I was a fanatical muso from the age of about 7 or 8, and I knew what I wanted to do. And all I can remember is I had to wait so long.
The great thing is he says, because I want you to, let's say, these triplets need to be very, very in time, or if they're not, you won't sound sarcastic, and that's my point. And so that's a gift that we don't get with singing any music by dead composers.
So George Benjamin is a musical alchemist who takes voices, words and stories and transforms them into a new element of glistening sound, vibrant colour and timeless art. And on the 18th and 19th of March 2016, you could have witnessed the performance of his acclaimed opera Written on Skin, a premiere, as mentioned, of Dream of the Song, and an intimate lunchtime concert of his works. Do note this interview was recorded before the passing of composer and conductor Oliver Nussum in 2018. So first, we visited Benjamin's home in West London to learn more about the composer himself.
Composers lead in this modern age of very busy lives. I mean, where are you at the moment? This programme that we're going to be talking about is next March. But I presume you kind of have to work a long way in advance and you're busy juggling.
Well, I'm about to go to New York tomorrow, in fact, to go to the USA stage premiere of my opera Written on Skin with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. I'm not conducting, but I will be conducting a concert there as in the Mostly Mozart Festival. And then I come back, and then I have to conduct the world premiere of Dream of the Song, my new piece, Amsterdam with the Concertgebouw at the very end of September. But apart from those two things, I have virtually nothing in my diary for the next 6 months, and in fact for the next 3 years, because I'm writing a new opera and my life is really dedicated to that, almost to the exclusion of anything else.
I get the impression from what I've read and from meeting you that if you could get away with it, you would write music all day long, every day.
I wouldn't want to do that because I like to have some life in the middle as well. But also I love contact with musicians. This June, I was at the Aubrey Festival in residence for about 3 weeks, working with a sinfonietta and working with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra and with my great friend Pierre-Laurent Aymar and various other wonderful musicians, Olly Nussen, great friends of mine. And I just had the most wonderful time. So I love to make music. I love to travel as well. But I need to be very seriously marinated in pieces in order to write them. And if I leave them for too long, it takes me a very long time to get back into them. And if I really do concentrate on them, then they begin to flow. And that's the ideal thing. And to get a sufficient degree of cohesion and unity and to hear very precisely what you're writing, it's best to concentrate really purely on the task in hand. Debussy once said, you either live or you compose. And he lived plenty, but I do know what he meant.
You seem to spend various parts of your life as a teacher, a conductor, and a composer. But it sounds like all of those help each other or more intertwined.
Yes, that's the case. But in surprising ways. As a conductor, I gain immeasurably from my experience of working with live musicians, and I'm privileged now to be able to work with really wonderful musicians. Mm. And that is a very great joy. And I learn things perpetually, not only about composing, but also about conducting every time I do it. But actually, the difference between composing and conducting is extreme. Composing is something which comes note by note, gradually, within silence, reflection, meditation on the structure. Every decision has ramifications way beyond the individual note itself. While conducting is something communal and something social and something which usually gets done within 4 or 5 days, and therefore, and is energetic and physical. It's absolutely, the subject is music, but you couldn't be further apart. teaching, that's different. That doesn't usually have much impact on my conducting, but it does on my composing. Mm. I've taught and I've loved teaching for the last, 30 years, more, in order to explain some harmonic, structural, rhythmical, aesthetic, stylistic element to a student. So I really have to understand it myself, and that forces me to keep on learning. Plus contact with young composers, some of them extremely gifted, I'm very proud of my students, is immensely stimulating and, yes, can occasionally sprout new ideas.
You achieve success fairly early on. There's obviously the Proms performance when you were 20. Do you think that was a good thing? Or do you wish that you'd had a more gradual growth into the composer you are now?
I thought it was a wonderful thing at the time, and I still think it was a wonderful thing. I was extremely fortunate that the BBC... Robert Ponsonby decided to put my work in the Proms, and that the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Mark Elder did such a wonderful performance. But I had been fortunate before in having such fantastic teachers, particularly Messiaen in Paris, to whom my first orchestral piece, Ring by the Flat Horizon, is dedicated. No, and I had also already the support of my publisher, Faber Music, with whom I've almost reached 40 years. Wow. So I was 16 when we started, were sort of making contact. So I was a fanatical muso from the age of about 7 or 8. And I knew what I wanted to do then. I knew I wanted to do this. And all I can remember is I had to wait so long. Because, you know, when you're 11 and 12 and you dream about seeing a piece of yours in print, like all the collection of scores that I've got, and to hear someone really good play it as opposed to the very willing but not necessarily competent school friends that I had. So, and I was already in Paris when I was 16 with Messiaen. And so, yeah, it was very exciting, but I had felt that I'd waited a long time, plus I worked very hard. And the other thing is, regardless of their quality, those early pieces of mine, they still get played. So I don't want to quote a French song, but I don't regret much.
I know it's different for everyone who composes, but I mean, how do you see the music? I mean, is it fully composed in your head before you put pen to paper? Well, I presume you do paper rather than computer.
I do paper, yes. I think that's a myth of music is fully composed in your head. It's meant to have been the case with Mozart. But it wasn't the case with Beethoven. And once the harmonic style during the 19th century became more complex and language began to mutate, then no, the act of composing creates the music. And often ideas that one has in one's head for textures or for lines or for anything, they're not as good as what happens when you actually compose with material. And often they're cliched. And that's a big mistake. You want something fresh and authentic in a piece at every moment. So Lutoslawski had a nice idea about describing composing, that you're flying very high up in the clouds and gradually you descend and elements of the landscape become visible, and the nearer you get, they become clear, and then you land and everything's done. The fact is there's a lot of confusion and mystery involved in starting any piece of music. You don't know what you want, you don't know how to do it, you have no idea, and maybe what you want is related to what you've done before and therefore not very interesting. How to find the way into really genuine creativity and come up with something really fresh and interesting and new? Well, one learns a little bit as one goes along. And I do have a little bit more idea of how my mind and my ear work than I did many, many years ago. So you can stimulate it, you can help it, you can channel it, you can challenge it. And then, if you're fortunate, things take off. It's a very peculiar process to go through. Mm-hmm. And one hopes that a piece of music gives the feeling of spontaneity, as if it was invented really in the head, as it were, in real time. But that's an illusion.
Let's sort of slowly move into these three concerts. The first one features the premiere of Dream of the Song. As you mentioned already, is conducted by your friend Oliver Nussen. Do you consider him a contemporary?
He's a little bit older than me, Ollie, as well. It seemed quite a lot older than me when we were young. It's about 8 years older than me. But we've been great friends since the end of the 1970s, and really very great friends. I'm so lucky. So he's been a wonderful friend to me musically, a wonderful friend to me altogether. Plus, we laugh an awful lot. We speak very frequently, and he's the funniest person that I know. Every sort of...
You wouldn't guess that.
Oh, heavens. I went out to dinner with him a couple of nights ago, and the jokes he was telling, I could not even begin the first line. Anyway, but we're very, very great friends. And apart from being a magnificent composer, he's also a magnificent conductor. So I'm delighted that with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, BBC singers, and Estyn Davis, he'll be giving the UK premiere of this piece, yeah.
What conversations do you have about the music?
When we're talking on the phone, sometimes suddenly the conversation gets very intense and extremely serious, and I can have some real nuts and bolts conversations with him about any element of music.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the actual piece itself. Where did this come from? How did this begin?
Many things, many divergent things, too many things maybe to mention. But one of the inspirations was the idea of writing a work for countertenor and female chorus, in which the sound of eight solo singers would, as it were, surround and encase the sound of the countertenor. Quite similar registers, very similar registers, but so different in timbre and sound, and in expression as well. That's one thing. Then the poetry that I've chosen comes from two sources. In fact, it comes from three sources. The primary source, what the countertenor sings, are 11th century Hebrew poems from Andalusia. This very little known poetry has been translated in a large volume called, in fact, Dream of the Poem, by the American poet Peter Cole, who was very helpful indeed to me while writing this piece, giving me advice about the background to the poetry. So that's what the countertenor sings, and it's secular poetry. Very beautiful. The chorus sings poetry also from Andalusia, from Granada, but it's 20th century. And it's Lorca, and it's a specific cycle of poems which was inspired by 8th, 9th century Andalusian Arabic poetry, which is the case with the Jewish poetry, also from the 11th century. So in a way, there's a hidden source to all the poems, which is Arabic poetry of the extraordinary civilization in Andalusia of the 9th, 10th century. And then there's this Hebrew poetry translated into English, and the Spanish poetry in Spanish. Beyond that, I'd have to read you the poetry. The subject matters are varied, but there's quite a lot of rumination about the passage of time and mortality, I suppose. But it's diverse as well.
Let's take a pause there and catch up with countertenor Estyn Davies, who will further unravel the mysteries of Dream of the Song, though at this point the finished work has just arrived in the post.
First time I encountered George's music as a sort of countertenor soloist was written on skin, really. I was sent to George's house and essentially to go and sing to him, because at the time he was, I think, at the end of writing the piece, and it had been commissioned amongst various houses, but especially by Aix-en-Provence, where it was premiered, and the cast was set in stone. He knew he was writing it for. However, this piece was going to do quite an elongated tour around Europe. So I was mooted to replace the Countess Beja Mater at certain stages. So George, he'd heard me on the radio, actually, and he'd not put the name to the face or the face to the name. I went and sang to him. That was it. And then he sort of briefly explained what the piece was about. And he gave me a copy of his Into the Little Hill on CD and sent me off. And then I went to the premiere at X to watch. And I can't remember ever seeing anything that I wasn't so struck by. I remember the end of when the second curtain comes down, just the power of the music, that you could feel the sort of the united breath of the audience being expelled as the curtain went down. It was really, really moving. The primary impact was so strong that I knew that this was kind of a good move to be part of it.
Is he a composer who writes strongly for the voice?
I think everybody you speak to who was involved with Written on the Skin certainly would agree that he is one of the most singable of composers. And that's not to say that it's primary colours and the kind of music that people would necessarily be able to easily listen to first time, but it's very apparent, I think, to the audience that the singers don't go through any discomfort. George gets the lyricism of a human voice and he writes very well for countertenor in particular. The way he wrote for Bajan in the bottom of the range as well, which is something which I really appreciated. And also the way that the voice is set against or set amongst the texture of the orchestra, it just seems to... It's different from, say, I don't know, if I compared it to, say, Handel, where you feel like you're sitting on the surface at the top of the tune. You're sort of in amongst the tapestry of sound in George's thing, and you're not fighting against the sound either. So it's a very much a chamber sort of feel to it, even though, you know, the orchestral palette is quite big in Written on Skin.
I thought it might be nice, one of the recent appearances, though I know you're at the Barbican quite a lot, but one of the recent appearances was for Nico Muhly's Sentences. Yeah. Both composers now writing and writing very well for the countertenor, but interesting to maybe ask how they differ.
Well, I think they differ just simply as composers in the sound world they inhabit. It's very obvious that they come from different schools. However, I think where they're similar is that, like you said, they do write very well for the person in question. In particular, for me, with Nico, is he is perhaps, I say, more forgiving. But Nico, you can contact him during the writing process, and he will send you excerpts and say, "How do you like this?" Or, whereas I know for a fact that George is very much, you know, the way he can concentrate on his work and let it come from his pen is by almost closing himself off at a sort of monastic existence, I think. Mm. I know from just even having conversations with him about the new work, he has very specific times of the day at which he's available to talk, and which I quite like, because I think it's so easy to contact people these days with mobile phones that it's you take it for granted they're going to answer. And in fact, just before I started this interview, I was having a text with him, and I find myself very apologetically saying, "Oh, sorry for disturbing you, because have I just interrupted this aria?" And he's now going to have to sort of throw it on the bin, and I can imagine that sort of happening. But George has conducted a lot of his work, and when you get to sing his work for the first or second time with him, you find out things which you may not do correctly, maybe whether it's rhythmic things and or dynamic things, and he will say, "No, please will you do this, because I mean underlining it all is because I spent 4 years sitting in a dark room writing it, but the great thing is," he says, "because I want you to, let's say, these triplets all need to be very, very in time or very, very metric, because if they're not, you won't sound sarcastic, and that's my point." And so that's a gift that we don't get with singing any music by dead composers. That's the very reason. I mean, love to have Handel say, "Look, the reason I wrote this is very specific because I want you to sound melancholic," or whatever it is. We don't get that, and it makes you look back at the music that you sing a lot of the time, whether Mozart or Handel or Gluck, and reevaluate what we think is authentic and how we approach authentic sort of historical practice. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you were approached to be involved in this concert, how was it explained to you?
Well, in the very basic terms, it was a song cycle for countertenor and orchestra with a female chorus. And that's as much as I got. And to be honest, that's as much as you need when you're asked to give a premiere of a George Benjamin work, albeit the British premiere. So I was completely flattered to be asked.
Okay, maybe the next stage is then you get a score in the post, is that right?
Yeah. The next stage exactly is you. I got the score in various... I'm holding it now. In various stages, actually. To start with, I sort of had the perusal score, which I've got here. In the front, they have sort of property of Faber Music, and then it says manufactured on 18th of March 2015. And then I look at the vocal score, and this says manufactured 7th of May 2015. And so there's obviously little corrections and various things, maybe to do with the laying out of the score, actually, rather than notes. But yeah, I'm a sort of... a grade 8 standard pianist who didn't do anything but learn the pieces for the exam. So I'm not the world's greatest sight reader. However, it doesn't take long to decipher this sort of music. I've got the vocal score is always reduced to a piano score, so it makes it slightly easier. And I was sent a recording of the premiere, which speeds everything up by a million. It's funny. It's like a sort of looking at a map. You see straight away it's by George Benjamin. I don't know what it is. There's something. Even the first page actually is very reminiscent of the opening sequence of Written on Skin. Time suddenly stops and the singer comes in, and I think that's it. It's like a full stop and a coda and saying, right, here we go. This is the singer. He's entered.
I was looking at some of the reviews of the first performance, and there was a great thing where someone described it as the idea of looking at water and the reflections of sunlight on water. Yeah. I'm excited just from that description of what it possibly could sound like.
Yeah, I mean, it does sort of have that quality a lot of the time, and in fact, the allusions to whether it be moonlight, there's a lot of moonlight in it. But I like that sort of translucent reflection of water. It is very much the thing. And in fact, that rings a bell for one of the movements where, when I was trying to learn it on the piano, playing the piano score, it's very, you know, it's sort of percussive. You can hear all the movement of the strings. On the recording, you don't see the conductor, you just listen. And I thought, I can't tell where the beat is, because the way in which the strings are coming out of each other, it did feel like it was rippling. And it's so nice that it links back to 18th century music, which is, the score is simply a way of transmitting what the composer has in his head, the quickest way to transmit what they want performed. And isn't that amazing for the composer to sit there and have that something that, you know, pressing on genius that composers such as George have?
A lot of the work that you do in your career, there's aspects of acting. When you have a work like this where it's the poetry is so key, do you feel that you're a storyteller, or someone who has a message or an idea to get across?
I think it's a nice way to think about it. But certainly the place that starts is looking at the poetry and looking at the text and putting yourself in perhaps some sort of imaginary scene for each song. Obviously, I can never get away from the sort of acting side of it, because I enjoy performing. So there's always going to be a bit of me in there. And I think that's true of all actors, actually, in general, that people say, oh, so-and-so's a wonderful actor. But actually, there's quite a lot of them in that thing that is the thing that etches them out from somebody else. I've just worked with Mark Rylance, who, you know, everybody is raving about. He's just, you know, a wonderful performer on stage, such good timing and spontaneity. But when you work with him and you know him and you see him in the dressing room and stuff like that, it's not to devalue what he does, but there's so much of Mark in his performance, or certainly so much of his performance in Mark. I'm not sure which way it is. And I tend to think, oh, that's a bit like singing, really, because singing is so personal too. It's not like a violin where you can sort of switch off at the end of the day and put it away in the cupboard. You do sleep with your instrument in your body and you wake up in the morning and it's there. And when it comes to performing George's songs, you know, we succumb to colds and all those kind of things, which sometimes people can enjoy your performance so much more. Something comes across when you're on the edge and you don't have much voice because you're feeling a bit ill, and you give something completely different in the performance, which you think is a dreadful performance, and everyone says that was really, really alive, and you think, yes, because I gave everything, because I had nothing. But hopefully, fingers crossed, none of that will occur. None of those things. I've been falling over a lot recently, but I try not to again.
Back to the composer, George Benjamin, and I asked him about the intimate lunchtime concert of his chamber works, Lunchtime with George.
I believe this is kind of a sort of a relaxed affair.
Not for the viola players. They're playing my piece Viola Viola, which is really, I think, the hardest viola duet ever written in any case. It's really hard, and apparently the Mahler Chamber Orchestra viola players are going to do it off by heart, which has only been done by one pair of players before. It really is very hard, and there's no cellos and violins to hide behind in the piece, so it's a very, very hard piece. I hope it will sound really good in the St. Luke's acoustic, because it needs a generous acoustic, because the idea of the piece is that there are two violas on the platform, but if you were to close your eyes, you might think there were five and a half. And what else is being played? A young and very talented British composer-pianist called George King is playing my piano piece, Shadow Lines, which is, I've written about five pieces for the piano. This is the one that I prefer. And I wrote it in 2001 and 2002, initially for my great friend Pierre Aymar. George has recorded it, in fact, on CD, and I didn't work with him at all, and the recording is good, so I was very happy that he was able to come along and join us. And then there's a very early piece of mine, Flight for Solo Flute, played by the Mahler Chamber Orchestra's sensational first flautist. And there's my little transcription of Purcell, I think, one of my favourite fantasias, initially for viola da gambas, but I transcribed it for a rather curious group, celesta, clarinet, violin and cello. And then I think finally there's my transcription of a canon and a fugue from The Art of the Fugue by Bach for a slightly larger group. And there will be some conversation.
These seem to be pieces that you're particularly proud of, if I had to link them together.
Maybe Viola Viola and Shadow Lines are amongst my better. I haven't written really enough chamber music, you know, and I wish I had written more, and I hope that I will write more in the future, though I've got the opera bug rather badly.
I interviewed Philip Glass, and he described opera as the ultimate composer's device, the ultimate thing they can do. I mean, would you agree with that point of view?
Well, it is an extraordinary and thrilling form, one that I wanted to attack for many, many, many years and was unable to do until I met Martin Crimp, the British playwright, who has had a transformative effect on my work. And I'm starting my third opera at the moment, and it's in a monumental challenge to deal with something so huge, with so many notes across a really large span of time.
It must be very hard to let your music go.
Yes, it's very hard. When you think that those sounds, with quite a degree of precision, have been locked inside a head for 2-3 years, But equally, there's nothing more thrilling than see it coming to life. Mm. And what's wonderful about opera, as opposed to doing concerts, is that the preparations take more than two or three months. And so you have rehearsals with just the music and the singers and piano. Then you add a little bit of direction and more direction. And then comes some staging. And then comes the stage itself with the set and the lighting. And then comes the orchestra alone. And then the orchestra with the singers. And then everything put together. And it's the most thrilling journey. I was very fortunate that in Aix, we had the most fantastic cast for whom I designed the work. And the most fantastic orchestra, the incomparable Mahler Chamber Orchestra, for whom I wrote the music. With their sound in my head. It was a fantastic experience, and I'm overjoyed that at least three of the cast from the original production will be singing it in the Barbican, including Barbara Hannigan and Christopher Purvis.
Was it a natural decision to conduct? Because I would imagine if I've done all that work that I would not necessarily want to have the responsibility on the night to bring it to life.
Well, with my first stage piece, Into the Little Hill, I deliberately didn't conduct the premiere. That was done by my friend Franck Olu with the Ensemble Moderne in Paris. With this one, well, there was one conductor I went to ask if he would do it, because this is someone who's been, perhaps I won't name him, but very important to me over the last 30 years. And he had been trying to get me to write an opera ever since I was about 25. So I felt that in a way, now at last that I'd done it, that it belonged to him. But sadly, he wasn't free. He couldn't. He just absolutely could not do it. And then there was some deliberation. There was one other person I thought of as well. But then with the director of the Aix Festival, Bernard Fokrul, we discussed it. And then the feeling was, well, it would be might be interesting if George does it himself. Mm. And so I did it. Yeah, it's a huge weight of responsibility. Can you imagine? What harm as a conductor I can do to me as a composer within 90 minutes? But at the same time, with this, surrounded by these wonderful musicians in the pit and on the stage, I felt such support from them, and so it was. In the end, I think it worked out.
Let's move to Martin Crimp. The story of this opera, I was reading the synopsis, and it's incredible. I suppose it's the best way of describing it is, I suppose, like a very gory fairy tale. Maybe tell me a little bit more about how you came to the subject matter and then how the working relationship worked.
The subject matter, well, there's two things to say about that. The only requests from Bernard Fokrul, a man I'd known and liked enormously for over 20 years, he'd been asking me to write an opera for that long. The only thing he asked in Aix-en-Provence was, gently he asked, please, if you could set it here on this terrain, I'd appreciate that. So Martin and I immediately began to search for stories to do with Provence. Now, the history of Provence, and particularly the age of the troubadours, is immensely, immensely rich. And fortunately, Martin's oldest daughter, Catherine, was studying at Cambridge at the time, and she was studying something to do with medieval poetry, I think. And she went to her professor to say, my dad would like to know, do you have any stories from medieval Provence that could have a link, could be good for an opera? And he provided her with five or six stories very kindly, and she then showed them to her father, and there was this one called Le Coeur Mangé, the Eaten Heart, and Martin was enthralled by it immediately, and he showed it to me, and it's only five pages long. I was enthralled by it. I was enthralled by the fact that it's so simple, that it's so dramatic, but its conclusion is quite extraordinary. It'd be extraordinary for an author to come up with something like this today. And therefore, it was decided very quickly. That was decided very quickly. And as for the collaboration between Martin and me, well, in the first thing we did, Into the Little Hill, which was a sort of testing terrain for us, he wrote the text, and then I composed it. And while he was writing his bit, I didn't say very much, and I didn't talk too much while I was writing the piece. We talked enormously before he started the text on choosing the subject matter, the Pied Piper of Hamelin, and the style, the aesthetic and dramatic style used. But once confidence had really shown itself between us, then we collaborated more closely on Written on Skin. So we talked enormously about all manner of things to do with the nature and the style of the work. And then he would go into Perda and disappear for almost a year, in fact, to write the text. And then he'd hand it over to me. What he does is so perfect. I asked to change nothing, really.
We mentioned at the heart of these three concerts, the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. You talked about understanding and admiring their sound. I mean, for you, what is their sound?
The first time I heard the Mahler Chamber Orchestra was when the beginnings of the project in Aix started getting underway. And the festival invited both Martin and me to hear Pierre Boulez's performance of, and Patrice Chéreau's direction of, The House of the Dead of Janáček, which was magnificent. And I can still hear the freshness, the articulation, the beauty of sound of what was coming from the pit in that performance. Then I conducted them in Lucerne. A year or two later, I did a program which ended with Schumann's Second Symphony, a piece that I love. And their playing is just a dream, a dream. Their sense of ensemble, they're much easier to conduct than many orchestras because their ensemble is so tight that a lot of the time they don't need you. And it feels like some sort of golden, sort of Aeolian harp in a way. And that was all the contact that we had before I started writing the opera. But those particular qualities were in my mind while I was writing the piece, as were indeed the individual qualities of the singers for whom I designed the opera as well. Mm. So I wasn't writing in abstract, I was writing for a specific sound. I tend to start pieces very slowly and then write at an enormous pace towards the end. With Written on Skin, the first scene I remember took me 6 months to write, and the last six scenes, fully orchestrated, took me 4 months to write. So the acceleration is gradual, but once it gets going, is enormous towards the end. It's possible, it would be nice just to be a sort of note-producing machine, not machine, but entity. Yeah. That when it flows and it goes even smoothly and goes fast and you're flowing with it. With Written on Skin, I finished it on my 52nd birthday, on the day, and I was intending to do that. And when I say finished, I wrote the last note, literally the last note. I've only got a few weeks of distraction in the whole of next year away from my new opera, and this is in fact the final thing in a very short period. So it's a very important thing for me, and I'm very greatly looking forward to it.
Both George and Yeston are artists and people brimming with creativity and focus, both extremely generous with their time and answering my questions. I'm Ben Eshmade. Thanks for listening to this archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast, here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and theme series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review. That really helps us get the word out.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.